This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
McLean County could soon join thousands of other local governments around the country in suing drug makers and distributors over the opioid epidemic.
And that certainly suggests to me, just on the sheer number, that the controls weren't in place.
State's Attorney Don Knapp talks about his plan to recoup the cost of fighting opioid abuse. Plus, we visit a new independent pro wrestling company that's based in Normal, and we'll hear some great music from Stone and Snow and Sugar Beats. All that after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. McLean County could soon join the thousands of local governments that have sued drug makers and distributors for their role in the opioid epidemic. The goal is to recoup some of the cost of fighting opioid abuse. McLean County State's Attorney Don Knapp is proposing filing suit in federal court in Ohio, joining litigation already underway. He said it took him and his predecessor, Jason Chambers, close to 2 years of research before deciding to sue.
Well, I know it was trendy for a lot of people to jump on the litigation right away, but for me, I wanted to clarify some things in my own mind because, you know, just looking at it from the 30,000-foot view, we're going to be, or I'm going to ask the boards for the board's input on whether we should bring suit, whether I should bring suit against manufacturers of a product that are legally entitled to manufacture the product and then distributors of a product that are legally entitled to distribute the product. And so that is nothing I take lightly.
And in your memo, you talk about how if you don't do it right, the end results, is how you put it, the end results may actually prohibit those in need from getting their medication. So how so?
Well, a lot of people need these medications, and we were talking a little off air about the opioid summit that we had, and one of the pain specialists in town spoke at that summit. And these are medications that he prescribes daily to people who need it. And I don't want manufacturers of any product to fear coming into McLean County saying, we don't want to be part of that because we risk being sued for doing things we should be doing. And so I think, at least in talking to my colleagues, there were a lot of people who rushed in for one reason or another. Some of us that were more deliberate wanted to make sure that the people who need these products can still get them. And so I was very deliberate in this.
So what ultimately pushed you over the edge, and how did you make that decision?
As you know, I studied the law, and with Michelle Sims' help, learned the law quite a bit to where I'm comfortable saying that I understand the federal regulatory scheme and the statutes, not just the United States Code, but the Code of Federal Regulation, that mandates that manufacturers and distributors of these products have significant controls in place to identify suspicious orders. And suspicious orders is a defined term, a very technical term in the statute. And that it sure seems to me that evidence exists that those controls were not in place, which allowed suspicious orders to be delivered to McLean County. As I noted in my memo, we won't have, because of a judge's order out of, I believe, Ohio, I don't have it in front of me now, but I studied the judge's order that denies us the ability to get information out of the ARCOS system, which is just a federal database, for lack of a better term, to give us incredibly specific information. But Ms. Sims' group was able to comply with that order, but also had the wherewithal through the Freedom of Information Act to obtain data that we believe will be backed up by the ARCOS data to show us, as I put in the memo, in 2015, during the height of the opioid epidemic, for lack of a better term, over 6.7 million individual doses of opioids came to McLean County. And that certainly suggests to me, just on the sheer number, that the controls weren't in place. And you know, if the ARCO system shows something differently, we'll adjust. But that's what got me over it. When I could match the law with the evidence that was presented to us, that's what got me over the hump.
The outside counsel you want to hire, Melissa Sims, provided to the county some preliminary data that she obtained from the state. It shows a surge in opioid prescriptions here, including at the height of the opioid epidemic in 2015. So what does that data show, and how will joining this litigation give you visibility into better, deeper prescription data for McLean County, this so-called ARCOS database?
Some of the data that we have deals with liquid doses versus pill doses. So it's really, until we get the ARCOS data, I look at this as pretty good data, but it could be something that changes my opinion, changes the county board's opinion once we get it, that maybe we get the ARCOS data and we say, boy, we were slow to this, or maybe we get it and we say, you know, there is an evidence here that suspicious losses or suspicious orders came to McLean County. So this is, you know, we make judgments based on the best information and data that we have. This is the best that we have right now. And I won't say a judge's order is prohibiting us from getting better data. It's just, to comply with the judge's order, we won't get better data until we actually join the litigation.
It seems like the goal would be to get back money that the county has spent by combating the opioid epidemic in various ways. Has the county quantified how much that is? I mean, how do you even know how much to sue for?
We haven't quantified that, and the mechanism of compensation in these specific lawsuits will be based on various data sheets, mainly derived by the doses coming out of the ARCO system. So that's not the only metric. If we sign the engagement agreement that we've put in the executive committee packet, we will then have to provide certain data to Ms. Sims's law firm that will then will go into the national litigation. There's somewhere between 2,000 and 7,000 units of government, I want to say, that are either already in or anticipated to be in. And so our compensation will be based on metrics that, quite honestly, I'm not an expert in explaining, but that's probably one of the questions that I think the county board may have for Ms. Sims, either tonight or at the county board meeting.
And what is the venue in which you'd be suing?
I believe it's the Eastern District of Ohio. I put that in the memo. It's wherever the judge's order is out of. It would be federal court. And back to the county's costs, I don't think, from what I'm hearing about what potential settlements are, and let's take the tobacco, the global tobacco settlement from years ago that was $360 some billion. I believe $9.1 billion of that was directed to Illinois. I don't expect, from what I'm hearing in the legal community, the entire settlement to even be $9 billion. So I don't think that – I would be surprised if we are talking tens of thousands of dollars recovered, or even hundreds of thousands of dollars recovered. But as I was analyzing, as I was talking to my colleagues and peers – you know, one of the costs we certainly have, the county certainly has, as the entire community does, is the cost of Narcan. And I believe every Narcan kit that every first responder and John Sandage's deputies carry costs about $1,000 a piece. So for my time and my effort to learn this and filing the litigation, if we get back anywhere between even $5,000 to $25,000, that's 5 to 25 new Narcan kits, right? Again, Ms. Sims would be better. I think Ms. Sims would be better able to comment on what a compensation may or may not be. I do know I've talked that through of how that works, and one of the things in my memo, when I talk about working with administration, there are certain metrics that we're going to have to provide to the national group of plaintiffs. Exactly what all those are, I don't know, but I also do know that the ARCOS database will drive a lot of people's compensation, and that probably makes a lot of sense, because that will drive where these suspicious That'll quantify where the suspicious orders were directed.
And is there sort of a list of manufacturers and distributors that that you'll be naming as defendants in the suit? You are now pointing to a long list on a as defendants on a lawsuit.
Yeah, there's a long list of drug manufacturers that we'll name.
So can you explain to people how the contingent fee basis works? This is the method by which this outside counsel that you've brought in, Ms. Sims, to work on this case. How does that work? Is there a cap on that? Is it a percentage of what the county may or may not get?
It's a contingent fee basis that they don't recover anything from us unless we recover from the defendants that we bring suit against or they bring suit on our behalf. It's a common... it's a common method used in litigation and civil litigation all throughout the world, or at least throughout America, and it's capped at 25%. But again, that can be adjusted by court order as well. When I say capped, the agreement we look to sign says they take a 25% contingent fee on what we collect. That's what's in the packet. A judge could certainly adjust that one way or another, which also happens all the time.
What's next here? You go before the McLean County Board's Executive Committee tonight, so we are recording this Tuesday. And then what? How quickly could you file the suit?
And if the county board believes it a worthy cause, they will execute a resolution declaring the actions of the opioid manufacturers and distributors created a public nuisance. All of that is in the packet, can be read by anybody, can get online and read that. And then it would be soon thereafter. We would, as the packet also says, I'd have to work with administration to execute some documents, but I don't think it would take even 30 days after the resolution for us to get the suit on file.
That's McLean County State's Attorney Don Knapp. His plan to sue drug makers and distributors over the opioid epidemic next goes to the full county board. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The wide world of sports in Bloomington Normal just got a whole lot wider. A new independent pro wrestling company based in Normal is approaching its one-year anniversary with plans for expansion. There's nothing quite like the crowd at a professional wrestling match. Yeah, they're wearing t-shirts for the wrestlers they love, and they're screaming at the ones they hate, just like any other sport. But there's a knowing smile on most everyone's face. They're in on it. 31-year-old Corey Jacob Esparza from Bloomington Normal has been wrestling his whole life.
So a lot of people refer to it as the magic. There's just a certain magic that you create when you're putting on a good match, when you got the crowd rolling, they're with you on every step of the way, your match, the way it's laid out, is going to plan, and everything's kind of hitting on all cylinders. There's just this connection with the crowd, and there's this energy in the building, and it's the best thing.
CJ Esparza is part of the tag team duo Zero Gravity, along with longtime friend Brett Wilson. They were featured at last weekend's Iron Spirit Pro Wrestling event at Normal's Community Activity Center. Iron Spirit Pro is a young independent wrestling company, or promotion as they call it. It's a year old, and this was just the fourth event. The Rock may be a movie star, and the WWE is a cultural behemoth, but until recently, independent pro wrestling didn't really have a foothold in Bloomington Normal.
So all of a sudden, Bloomington's a little bit of a hot spot, which is awesome, because, like I said, I've been wrestling for 14 years, and there's never been any independent wrestling in Bloomington until just recently.
Logan Bruce is the founder of Iron Spirit Pro. He was inspired in part by the success of another downstate wrestling company, Dreamwave, years ago in LaSalle, Illinois. He says independent wrestling is in a boom period right now, just not in central Illinois. He says WWE isn't really appealing to hardcore wrestling fans anymore.
They don't really cater to, these things called like lapsed fans that used to watch in the 90s when it was super hot with the Attitude Era and stuff. And since then, it's gotten way more PG. It's really a kid's show, which is it was just fine, and ours is definitely a family-friendly show.
crowd was rocking last Saturday at the Iron Spirit Pro Volume 4. They brought in an old-school wrestling ring and plopped it right in the middle of a community activity center where you'd normally see people voting or kids playing floor hockey. It's the same building where the Heartland Theater Company does its shows, and it's where Nick Brubaker took acting lessons as a kid.
I also go by the wrestling name of Brubaker. My moniker, though, is the Filth King. I've gotten that name just because of, you know, my tactics in the ring, as well as some of my imagery, the tattoos and the piercings. And since this is a family-friendly show, I'm going to leave it at that.
Brubaker is one of the best-known Bloomington Normal wrestlers. He loves the theatricality of it, the combination of athleticism and charisma that he says other sports can lack.
As opposed to saying that we are looking like we're out there having real fights, it looks more like two superheroes clashing, which kind of allows for more leeway for the men and women to wrestle and for the smaller guys to wrestle the bigger guys and still have it be believable, because we're not out there saying that this is a real fight between two people, because we all know we're having fun out there.
That said, Brubaker has a laundry list of injuries.
Had my skull fractured, my nose broken about 20 times, my shoulder torn, my knee's terrible, my lower back's terrible. We're always in pain, or at least I am, but find ways to get through it so we can keep doing what we love.
One of the hardest parts is the business side of the business. For independent, unsigned wrestlers like Brubaker and Esparza, they try to book themselves an event or two every weekend. The goal is to get signed and get on TV. On weekends, Esparza is flying through the air with zero gravity. And during the week, he's a supervisor at Four Seasons, where he trains. Brubaker is a fitness coach at Orange Theory Fitness. He's also a father to a 5- and a 6-year-old. He's on the road a lot. The road is where he learned how to wrestle.
Just finding different strategies and different techniques to get the crowd to do what we want them to do, which is really the name of the game when we're out there.
On this Saturday night, the crowd was loving one of the youngest wrestlers on the bill, Savannah Stone. Unlike the others, Stone didn't grow up watching wrestling, idolizing Hulk Hogan or Shawn Michaels or Stone Cold Steve Austin. She was 16, a high school volleyball player. She saw a match on YouTube, thought it was cool, and told her parents, I want to do this.
It's the obvious reaction of when you say, hey, Mom, I want to go out and wear some skimpy clothes and wrestle in front of a bunch of guys. So you can only imagine that.
The 19-year-old Stone is from St. Louis, where she's in college still. She loves life on the road, like this night in Normal Wrestling, the sorceress, Holly Cromwell. Spoiler alert, Stone was the winner. It was the only women's match of the night. A few hours before it started, I asked Stone what it's like to be a woman in this business.
It's very, very hard. I'll tell you this. Anyone who's looking to be in this business, I absolutely say jump right along. Start as soon as you want. Follow your dream. But know that there's definitely a lot of challenges, especially starting young in the business, like I said. But any age, really. I mean, if you're a woman, man, it doesn't matter. But especially a woman, it's very hard. Have close friends, but don't trust everyone. But again, your fans are what's going to get you through.
Her goal is to get signed, to join a larger wrestling promotion and work her way up to the big time. And she's already had a taste of it. She wrestled on WWE Raw once back in 2018. She says her favorite part is the fans.
There was one time I was working a guy. And because we're allowed to do that in wrestling, we're allowed to work girls, guys, weight classes, it doesn't matter. And there's a little girl who came in and was like, wow, we can beat the guys too? And I'm like, yes, of course. And this girl's like maybe 6 years old, you know. And like to be able to like have that match and her get something out of it like that, you know, that I love being able to give that to little kids, little girls, little boys and stuff like that. So that's, if I get that, that makes me happy.
Iron Spirit Pro founder Logan Bruce is also thinking about the future. He's expanding a bit into Champaign, running his first event there in September. And it's back to normal for another show in October.
So I could see us, you know, doing a 3 or 4 city loop around central Illinois of the towns that nobody's hitting, you know. But I always think Bloomington Normal is going to be our home.
After that, he'd like to get his shows onto a video on demand platform so that people can discover Iron Spirit Pro and its talent from wherever they are. You can see a photo gallery from last weekend's wrestling event in Normal at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. In the middle of a sunny summer, one local theater company is embracing its dark side with a musical that's a scream come true for the director. WGLT arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Community Players presents The Addams Family, a show that's creepy and kooky, mysterious and spooky. And it's altogether ooky because Wednesday Addams is all grown up and in love. What follows is a grave crisis and the threat of change. Samantha Smith is the director of the show. It's her first for the theater. Smith says for her and for audiences, this is the right show at the right time. And it's all down to the characters.
I think they're very relatable. You know, the cracking the code on the Addams Family is basically, for me, noticing that there is really no such thing as normal. And that's what Charles Addams always said, too. And the Addams Family say that specifically in the play here. You know, if you feel like an outcast or if you feel like you are, you know, maybe suffering something, I think the Addams Family want you to know that you're not alone and know that whatever your darkness is and whatever you find that you enjoy, to not feel like you're left out. There's something for everyone. And the Addams Family really, they are very unique and they celebrate that.
So let's talk a bit about the plot. We have here a sort of guess who's coming to dinner plot with this play.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we have Wednesday Addams is now 18 years old and Pugsley is 11. So, you know, with that comes different life stages. And the same goes for Morticia and Gomez. They're in a different stage of their own lives. So when they're meeting the Beinekes, Lucas Beineke, Mal and Alice, for dinner, we see the total different sides of the spectrum as far as the two families. The Addams are very dark and celebrate that darkness, and the Beinekes are much more straightforward, average American family. So that storyline is pretty common, you know, even looking at The Birdcage or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, stories that, you know, show very different families coming together and celebrating each other's uniqueness.
They're normal people, not like you, not like me. Please, can't we be an average family? One normal night, that's all I want, that's all I need from you. One normal house without a mouse to feed a plant or two.
This play, of course, you're going to have very unique characters and a very unique set. So can we talk a bit about the production design?
Yes. With the set, you know, Chris Turvin is our set designer, and he's done a fabulous job of making sure that we have some great playable space.
Yeah, you've got a lot of levels going on here.
And it does help to kind of signify the various floors on the Addams Family Mansion. And then we've got different set pieces that pay homage to the Addams Family in different ways that you might have known them or other people in the audience might have known them. For instance, just as of late yesterday, a Morticia chair, so to speak, a peacock chair, is up there that you're looking at now. So those kind of things are incorporated in the set to bring it to life for those in the audience. We wanted to make it so that the audience could feel like they could reach out and touch it, you know, very tactile, and extend as much of the set into the audience as possible with different pieces.
Well, the Addamses are unique characters. Why don't you tell me about the cast of actors who are going to be playing these interesting characters?
Yes, we've got Nick Benson, who's going to be Gomez, and we've got Callie Bundy, who's playing Morticia Addams. These are people that have done shows here before in the past for Players, and I'm just so excited to have all of our brilliant cast and crew involved in this production. We do have new people as well to Players or the stage, so we're excited to see them in there. And we've got people that, like Bruce Parrish, who is playing Fester Addams, who've been here many years.
You know, I love Gomez and Morticia so much. Mm-hmm. Tell me about their love story and what makes them so successful as a couple.
Absolutely. I also adore it myself. And it's one of those things that words aren't even necessary. It's almost a look of love in their eyes. And I loved trying to, you know, capture that, or were our efforts to capture that too. And the thing about Gomez and Morticia is, in the play you'll see, they try not to keep secrets from each other. And I think that's very noble for a relationship, is, you know, trying to keep that open line of communication going. And that's part of the plot of the story, too. So you'll see how even their relationship is faced with tests and challenges, and like any relationship.
The wind that makes a window creak, the mist inside the word mystique, Morticia. The fluttering wings of bats in flight, those creepy crawly things at night, Morticia. The moment she is focused on you makes you feel alive, and after she is through, you hope you only just survive. Not unlike being stung by every bee inside the hive, Morticia.
The score is very, you know, it's very fast-paced. It's got all sorts of different styles incorporated into it. Tango is in there as well, so you'll see tango, you'll hear tango music. Spanish flamenco is a huge influence on a certain, you know, several numbers. Andrew Lippa had done the music, and I had read that he tried to make each song specific to the character. So there are different elements of musical style relative to the character who's singing their song.
How are you going to pull off Thing, which is just a hand?
Well, that's a great question. We do have a prop Thing, so to speak, you know, that you'll see eventually.
Is it not a live Thing?
We do have a live version of that too. So, I mean, we have a specific answer to that is we do have stagehands that'll reach their hand out and perform different clicks, if you will, with their hand. And then we do have a prop hand for Thing at the end.
There's a lot of universal themes in the Addams Family musical, one of which is growing up. What is the musical trying to teach us about growing up?
As far as growing up goes, I think when I think about the Addams Family in this setting, at this time in their lives, they're going through these life stages, and sometimes those can be the scariest. You know, yes, they have a preference for the dark side of life and thunderstorms, and they look at things, you know, they flip normal upside down completely, and that's their comfort zone. But life stages such as meeting your daughter's fiance and their family, or secrets between lovers in a relationship, you know, those are things that can be just as dark and dangerous and scary. And I think that the Addams Family, you know, try to encompass that, you know, notion that if you move toward it, you know, you don't want to run away from it. That's what growing up is. I think you try to face your darkness.
It sounds like the overall tone of the play is spooky but touching.
Yes, very. I think so. Both hand in hand.
The Addams Family, as upside down as they are and unique as they are, they seem to have the secret to being a happy family. What is that secret?
I think the secret is that you don't have to be always happy to live a fulfilled life. If you're striving for happiness at every aspect, at every corner, at every inch of your day, it's kind of it's not reality, you know, and I think that the darkness it might sound strange, but it is truthfully when you have those moments of high and moments of low, that's kind of what the point of life is. If you can find your way through all of those moments and face them head on. Toward the Darkness is one of our songs at the very end of the Act Two, and it couldn't be a more truthful message for the audience, is that whatever you're facing, whatever crisis or pain you have, that, you know, you will find your light at the end of it.
That's Samantha Smith, director of The Addams Family, opening July 11th and running through the 28th at Community Players Theater. The play is rated PG-13. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear what director Samantha Smith thinks are the biggest challenges in directing a musical in some bonus audio at our website, wglt.org. One of the best-known musical duos in Bloomington Normal is releasing a new album this week. Stone and Snow, a.k.a. Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson, will host a release party Thursday at the Howard Hall in downtown Bloomington. WGLT correspondent Steve Fast previews their new work and learns what brought their voices together.
The Bloomington-based singer-songwriter duo Stone and Snow have been making music together for about 7 years. The core of their sound comes from a close vocal harmony that shows off the talents of singer-keyboardist Karen Bridges and singer-guitarist Clint Thompson. Despite the now seamless blend of their voices, prior to forming the group, they didn't know each other.
One of us, we can't remember, had an ad on the Craigslist Musicians Classifieds. Just responded to that, and
I put an ad out there. He responded to it. He was the first one, right. He got dibs.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't long after that we were, you know, kind of share some of the music that we both like to listen to, and we were definitely both, you know, listening to a lot of folk music. I think that's probably what we were coming together most on.
Americana.
Yeah.
It's been so long now. I don't remember.
I know. Yeah.
It was so long ago. People used Craigslist.
I know. They don't do that anymore.
So much of what you do is dependent on both of your voices and how your voices sound together. So was that something that clicked right away?
She had me do exercises, you know, because she was trying to figure out what my range was. You know, she needed to know that.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm, you know, usually incapable of coming up with my own harmony parts. So now that she knows my range, she can say, here, I made a recording of the part that you'll sing. Yeah. And, you know, and that works really well for me. So
I'm classically trained, so it was easier for me to be like, let me just figure out what you can do, and I'll come up with that for you, and let's give it a go. But I think it's just time, and just it wasn't there right away.
Oh, no.
I mean, it takes a long time singing together to sync up.
So how did the writing come along?
I don't think I had anything except maybe a random, you know, couple of guitar chords that I put together, but I don't really recall having anything prepared. I remember
you had Appaloosa. You had written that, and that's a song that we kind of reinvented and is on the new album.
That's right.
How old is that song?
Oh, gosh. Probably. It was already pretty well written.
It was already
written. Yeah, I already wrote that. 8 or 9 years old, maybe 10. Honestly, I don't know. I didn't do anything with it really until, you know, we recorded it on our first EP. And then, we've revamped it several years later.
Annapolis is a horse, right?
Yeah. So sometimes just random things will pop into your head, you know, when you're trying to, maybe, you know, you're not even trying to think of a song, or you've got a melody you're humming in your head and you're just trying to use random words. And I think that word just kind of came out, you know, naturally. I've always really liked those horses. Those were always my favorite horse when I grew up around family that had horses. So I don't know. I just felt like it came out naturally. So it then became a thing, a symbolic thing in the song.
The new Stone and Snow album, Love is a Weapon, takes its title from a song that made a splash when it was selected as a winner of the International John Lennon Songwriting Contest. With the contest win, Stone and Snow performed at the National Association of Music Merchants show in Anaheim.
No, I can't be a little overwhelming. It's hard enough for it.
We had already gotten a little bit of traction from NPR's Tiny Desk contest, where we did an acoustic rendition of it with the full band and submitted that for their contest in a video, and that was actually the audio from that video is what we had submitted for the John Lennon songwriting contest. So I think we thought, oh, somebody likes this, why not give it another shot somewhere else? And it paid off.
Sometimes I think the earth is gonna open up.
getting the recognition for Love is a Weapon allowed us to have that sort of name recognition with our fans, to where when we needed to raise funds to make a high quality recording, we could say, hey, we know you love this song. Please support us. We want to make it bigger and better.
The national exposure of Love is a Weapon gave a boost to the group's effort to crowdfund the recording of their next album with pre-sales. Thompson says that fan support gave them an opportunity to stretch their creative muscles and do some things they'd never attempted to do before when recording.
This record is different, I think, mostly because we did it, for the most part, as a live record. That's what we thought of first before we were ever discussing budget. It was like, we want to make a live record with a big room sound, you know, thing happening, because we hadn't done it that way yet. And then it came to exploring what can we do with still doing that idea. Can we go somewhere else? Can we go here? Can we go there? And I think what we settled on was just perfect, you know.
To do that, we needed a bigger space than what our engineer could offer us. So we did a little research and we found this wonderful little opera house in El Paso, Illinois, called the Legacy Opera House, and a couple that owned it and they're rehabbing it. It's just this beautiful historic space, huge tall ceilings. We basically moved in a recording studio for the weekend and spent 4 days there just going through all the songs and living there, basically. And it was wonderful. It was a good experience to just all be together and focus and to be in that historic space where the sound was just wonderful.
And to create that energy that we all create when we're playing live shows, to be able to create that and then put it on the record was what we were wanting to achieve. I think we did. It was a lot of fun.
There is that freedom in doing it all yourself in DIY and having your fans be a part of it and support you and elevate you and in that crowdfunding and pre-ordering. And they're giving you that vote of confidence, which helps propel you forward and gives you that license to do things your way.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Steve Fast with Karen Bridges and Clint Thompson of Stone and Snow. They're playing this week in Bloomington Normal, and we're discussing their new album, Love is a Weapon.
So when you were both starting Stone and Snow, was the music scene in Bloomington Normal the same as it is now? Did it provide you the same amount of opportunity? Has it changed? Is it better? Is it worse? Is it different? People want to hear different things?
I mean, we've certainly changed over the years, and I would say that as a woman, when we started, and even now, I don't really see female role models in the local scene. So I've kind of just had to carve my own way as far as being a woman in music, because that experience is different. We're just treated differently. A lot of times, I think women, female musicians, just like in any industry, we can very easily become victims of so-called personality flaws, right? So if you're assertive, you're bossy or bitchy. If you're self-assured, you're maybe arrogant, that sort of thing. Things that maybe aren't plagued by male counterparts. There's a song on the record, I think, that really speaks to my experience and my feelings about being a woman in music, and that song is Break Me Down. Line, I don't want to have something to prove, but I feel like I do. When we've performed it live, we've invited other women to perform that song with us.
The DIY mentality that Stone and Snow took to the recording of their album is extending to their bookings as well. Bridges says that just like finding the perfect space to record, they've took it upon themselves to develop a new space to perform.
We've made our own opportunities in a way. We started a micro venue with Haphazard Press, called the Hallowed Hall. It's a listening room. I call it a micro venue. It only seats 50 people, but we're coordinating booking the talent, and that's allowed us to have additional exposure, and it's allowed us to elevate women in the community because it puts us in a position of power as a gatekeeper. We have wanted to cultivate a listening room venue in Bloomington Normal for probably the entire time we've been making music together, because I think we share a feeling that that's really the best way to experience music, is when you can really get up close and listen to it.
Fell asleep with the light on. Haven't felt this way in so long. So long.
We have done a lot of house concerts, and we're like, we should try to bring this concept somewhere. So we approached Chris and Joel at Haphazard Press, knowing that they do a lot of work for bands, totally supportive of music and wanting to do interesting things in the community. And they were like, yes, wonderful, let's do this. We kind of like all came together with a singular vision to create an experience. And they designed a poster for every show. It really is an experience. It's not just a show. And I think anybody who's gone to a show there can tell you that.
We were talking about an earlier show you did. You said that's when you were a folk band. Are you a folk band? Are you still a folk band?
We are somewhere in the alternative folk space, I feel like. I don't know. Like, I feel like this record is really a rock record, but it has some, I don't know, it still has some folk undertones, I think.
We'll always have those undertones, I think. When we play as an acoustic duo, I feel much folkier, you know. Mm-hmm, but when we play, sure, you know, with our bandmates, I don't. I feel a little more rock and roll.
That's Stone and Snow with WGLT correspondent Steve Fast. Staying in the local music scene, songwriting is an important component for members of the Sugar Beats, the Bloomington Normal rock, blues, R&B sextet. Band members Diana Calvetti and Pat Sheridan stopped by the WGLT studios ahead of their performance this weekend at the Sugar Creek Arts Festival. Calvetti told WGLT's John Norton that her first stab at songwriting happened 30 years ago.
It was an inspiration. I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I had this song in my head, and I got up and I wrote it down.
So, do you remember the song? Do you still have it?
We do, and it is called Hysterectomy Blues.
Hysterectomy Blues.
I was probably blue about something.
Tonight it's all or nothing, babe. I got those hysterectomy blues. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
And there is no other song on the market called Hysterectomy Blues.
Calvetti, fellow vocalist Sandy Smith, and guitarist vocalist Pat Sheridan are the principal songwriters in the Sugar Beats. The band also includes bassist Steve Hill, as well as Ron Orland on drums, percussion, and vocals, and Sarah Schramm on vocals. Sheridan said his songwriting began just over 40 years ago. He was a freshman at the University of Texas at Austin, a school known nationally for its outstanding music program. That's when he met up with friend Robin Wink.
Rob was a songwriter out of Florida, and we would just sit around the living room and write, me and his brother, and it just kind of got into my craw from there.
And as with most people, life happened after that, and Sheridan put his music on the back burner. It wasn't until 2008 that serendipity happened.
I got fired from a band. Your band broke up. We're sitting around twiddling thumbs, and we hooked up and started a project. And the project was to be able to play again, but also to have something to get these songs out the door. Everybody in the band had their own version of the similar story, songs stacked in their head, and a history of stuff that's just been sitting there on the table, and bam, it just came out.
Well, who gets credit for Long Time from Sunday?
I wrote that when I was 28 and had no clue what I was writing about. And that was one back in the 80s that just kind of dropped in the back burner. And as we were finishing that first CD, I said, I need a blues song to throw on there.
It's a long time from Sunday since you walked out on your own.
What did you think you were writing about?
I was writing about people having troubles. I didn't know it at the time, but I was digging out,
yeah,
you know, hurt and life experience that I hadn't had yet. And I didn't know how apropos that was, you know, 20 years or so later. But that song, of all the songs on the CD, was just the easiest one to do. It was my favorite of all. Huh.
Now it's a long time from Sunday. I just can't take you from my mind.
The song is Long Time from Sunday. It's from the Sugar Beats. Our guest, Diana Calvetti, Pat Sheridan from the band. I want to go back to you, Diana. I've talked to a lot of musicians in town over the last few years, and we talk a lot about how it has really become a vibrant music scene here in the Twin Cities. But we don't talk a lot about some of the venues that you play a lot, which you play other venues as well, but you play Cheeks, you play Gill Street, you play Baxter's, you play the Windjammer. These are venues we don't talk a lot about because we talk about the Castle and Night Shop and Jazz Up Front. How important are these venues and how integral are these venues for the Bloomington Normal music scene?
Each one of those venues have their own audience. You can always count on performing at those places and having a good audience. They're important to the music scene because it gets music out to people who don't go to Castle,
yeah,
who don't go to Night Shop. You know, not only that, but our friends who are band groupies, I guess,
mm-hmm,
would come out to those places.
What I find interesting is you do see a lot of original music in town, too. We've had some musicians that we're friends with that have moved, like, to Dallas and things like that, and they want to hang themselves because they can't do their original work anymore.
In Dallas?
In the Dallas area, yeah. They say, you know, they come to a club or something of that sort, and there's an expectation of what type of style they're supposed to perform. So when you play a club, you know, there is a monetary factor. They're trying to bring revenue in. We're trying to play and have fun. And so I think all the venues out there just allow an opportunity to bring more onto the table. So what we do is a mix of the two. We'll take covers and send them into a pot, scrape them around a little bit, you know, and pour it out on the floor and see what we got. And we make an effort and an intentional effort to make the cover sound different than the original to give us some, you know, fun and flavor in doing so. And then we rotate the originals in. In my view, if you want to be a full original act, you got to be doing that kind of stuff full time.
The song is Whisper in the Wind. It's by the Sugar Beats. Diana Calvetti and Pat Sheridan from the band join us on GLT's Sound Ideas. Are you guys the primary songwriters, or do more people in the band write? Does everybody in the band write?
We have Sandy Smith, who is writing as well, and she has written some incredible songs, and she is singing on this song. Did you guys write that together, Pat?
No, that specific one was written by me and Greg Putnam. Greg Putnam works a lot with Eric over at Eclipse and targets the country market. And so he had a lyric just written down on a napkin. You know, I pulled it out of a book that he had, and I said, hey, can I borrow this? And yeah.
Huh.
And this sort of bluesish minor key thing came out of it, and then put it together and laid it in front of Sandy, and she just owned it.
You both talked about a couple of songs that you wrote. Diane, I'm going to start with you. Where does your best material come from?
Most of what I write comes out blues.
Lyrically?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's emotion. It's life.
Are you one of those where this fully formed song pops up into your head and you got to get out of bed at, like you said, 3 a.m. one time and write it down?
What I really like to do is, like, Pat will give me some music, or Gerard Montague will give me some music, and he'll say, I need lyrics for this. Give me an hour, give me a day, and depending on what they give me, I will have lyrics for them.
You have three lead singers. They're all female. Do you consider them three lead singers?
Yes, we're all lead singers, and we're all a strong vocal. We decide when we're going to do a song, who's going to do lead, by what key it's in, the style of music. It just fits.
And you harmonize together, too. Yes. And you're a saxophonist.
Yes. I started in sixth grade, but I played through my sophomore year of high school. Then I didn't play for about 32 years. And then I picked it up again.
What made you pick it up?
My children were grown and wanted something to do with my time and to get involved with musicians and enjoy the music.
Pat, what does the saxophone bring to this band?
It's always flavor and it's always spice, you know, and there's no restriction on what she does. But what I really like is, you know, you got the regular tenor saxophone. And you got some jazz musician that just can fly on this thing, you know, which is always fun. But she comes out with a Barry sax that's about as big as she is. That thing is just got a groove and a punch to it that is pure fun. You know, absolutely love that thing. And it's, what, a 60s Zephyr or something like
it's
that?
It's a 1962 King Zephyr. Yeah. And it has a bell on it that is lower than most. And so it brings a tone to it that is different.
Hmm. It's always in tune, and it's always fat, and she walks around the crowd with that thing, you know. It's a lot of fun, and I just love the tone of it, and it adds so much. So, mm-hmm.
Diana Calvetti, Pat Sheridan with the Sugar Beats, thanks so much for coming in. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you, sir, WGLT.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You can see Sugar Beats this weekend at the Sugar Creek Arts Festival. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, 89.1 and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's public media.